playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. Last Monday's Claire Byrne Live, produced by Jane Murphy, made for harrowing viewing. Her name is Clodagh, told the story of the brutal murder of 39-year-old teacher Clodagh Haw and her three sons, Liam, Niall and Ryan, by her husband and their father before he took his own life. Alan Haw, a national school vice principal, was once regarded as a pillar of the community in County Cavan. Clodagh's mother, Mary Coll, and her sister Jacqueline Connolly spoke with Claire Byrne for the first time since the murders 3 years ago. They described Alan Haw as evil and rejected claims that he was suffering from depression when he killed his family.
There were bits and pieces of information, and as you know, we went through an inquest and the law for the inquest is very limited, so we only find out where, when, how it happened and who it happened to, but we never found out the why. And we were advised that that probably would never happen at the inquest. But he has said in his own words that he was caught red-handed. And we do know that he was looking at pornography on the school laptop and he never brought the school laptop home. So we have pieces of information, but we don't know who caught him. This all happened the day before he was to return to school. So it was avoidance of the consequences he was about to face.
And he spoke in the letter, didn't he, about shame?
He kind of said that it was easier for them to die than to have to live with the truth of what he was doing.
We don't know, you know, after a full investigation, why we're left with these questions. We've requested the files from the Gardaí and they've declined that request to our legal representative. But we feel that an injustice has been done to Clodagh and the boys. We need the truth. We need to know why they died, out of respect for them, but to be able to let us have some peace of mind.
Paul Gilligan is the CEO of St Patrick's Mental Health Service. He gave his reaction to the programme to Samantha Labrary on Morning Ireland.
Clodagh Haw's family made clear in that interview last night that the inquest process wasn't enough to answer the questions that they have about why Alan Haw killed Clodagh, Liam, Niall and Ryan. Do you support their view that the Gardaí need to investigate these cases in a different way?
Well, firstly, I think they're showing immense courage. And secondly, I think that we need to look at all of these cases in a very thorough manner. They're horrendous cases, in particular this one. And we simply don't do enough work around why they might have occurred, what were the factors involved. And I think we're doing a disservice to the victims if we don't do that. That's not a criticism of the investigation. Investigations are about finding out who perpetrated the crime and was a crime committed. We need to go far beyond that. We need to find out what are the root causes of these types of events to help us learn and prevent them.
Clodagh's sister Jacqueline last night spoke about throwing a blanket of depression over the findings of the inquest, and you say that attributing acts of murder to mental health must only occur where we are certain. Why is that important?
I mean, it's crucial. Otherwise we do a disservice to the victims, but more importantly perhaps we throw a blanket of doubt and misunderstanding around people with mental health difficulties. You know, attributing is a very important word because it's not enough just to say somebody had a mental health difficulty. We need to really be sure that it was because of that mental health difficulty that they committed a particular act. If we don't do that, we're doing them a disservice. I think that the key here is that we need to check and look at the capacity of the person. If they had a mental health difficulty, did it prevent them from knowing what they were doing, understanding what they were doing? So these are all key questions. You know, there's a massive amount of stigma around mental health as it is. If we attribute acts like this to mental health without doing the thorough investigation, I think we're making a massive mistake and adding to the stigma.
And you also make the point that people with mental health difficulties are no more likely to commit violent crime than people without them.
Yeah, it's really important every opportunity we get to emphasise this. People with mental health difficulties can and often do harm themselves. They're no more likely to hurt other people. People with mental health difficulties, most people know they have a difficulty, they want to seek help. So I think we need to get rid of that preconception. It isn't helped when we have cases like this and when we start attributing in a way where we don't have the true facts.
Because of the issues raised in the programme, there was an increased number of calls to Women's Aid. Its CEO, Margaret Martin, spoke with Ray Darcy on Tuesday.
I I think everybody will say it, but the courage that Mary and Jacqueline showed, it's a really difficult thing to be able to actually speak about something that's really unspeakable, you know, which is what they did.
They described Clodagh and Alan's relationship from the start.
Yeah.
Did you spot, as you were looking at, any red flags?
Yeah.
So coercive control is now a crime in this country. Yeah. It's been a crime in the UK for the last 3 years.
Yeah.
So will you just explain again what coercive control is?
What it is people tend to think of domestic violence and they think of physical abuse. Yeah. So it's really trying to capture everything else, including the physical abuse. But the difference with domestic violence is it's this pattern building, these small pieces. So what coercive control really is about, it's about building up control over a number of incidents through power, through control, through coercion. And what's interesting when you stand back and look at it, and we have, you know, we have this poster about the 10 signs of dating abuse. An awful lot of it is about restricting her freedom of movement and her freedom of association.
He says he hates your friends and complains you spend too much time with them. He sends you constant texts and gets mad when you ignore him. He tells you how to dress and criticizes your clothes. He makes you feel guilty if you don't spend all your free time with him. He has a bad temper and you feel afraid to disagree with him. He accuses you of cheating on him all the time. He demands all your passwords so he can check your messages. You feel afraid to break up with him because he says he'll hurt himself. He forces you to do things sexually that you don't want to do. He is physically violent or threatens to hurt you or someone else. So any number of those can be red flags.
And it's the pattern.
Have they found people guilty of coercive control in the UK?
Oh, they have, yeah. Right. They have, all right. But it'll take a bit of time for that to happen in Ireland because, first of all, the law came in on the 1st of January, so it's not retrospective. So you could have been experiencing this for years. So it has to be then what's happening now. And then you have to be able to document it because also it's a criminal offence. So you need to be able to show what it is. You know, we all need to get better in terms of support services and the guards, etc., in what is the burden of proof, in a sense, that you have to meet.
And what is the burden of proof?
There has to be intent about it. There has to be an impact on somebody's well-being and their wellness. And there has to be that pattern.
Margaret Martin of Women's Aid. On Thursday, Clodagh's mother Mary and her sister Jacqueline had a very positive meeting with Justice Minister Charlie Flanagan. And the fallout from the Clare Byrne Live special was discussed on the gathering yesterday by political journalists Alison O'Connor and Niamh Lyons.
Charlie Flanagan met them yesterday, the Justice Minister. He's agreed now to have a kind of a legislative review and to look at a few of the very difficult areas that have cropped up for the family, stuff to do with inquests. They really wanted to know much more about the why. And that's not something that inquests cover. I'm not quite sure how you could change the law in that regard. Succession rights. The idea that families then have to go off and do battle for what they're entitled to in terms of family
estate. Because
Alan
Hall was the last person
to die. He was the last man
standing.
So therefore his side of the family inherited everything. Now, I don't think this is kind of in any way, shape or form a money grab. But the idea that a family are kind of left fighting and always doing battle with the state when something tragic happens.
Like Niamh, have carried it with me, you know, all week. It was just so sad and so disturbing, and I felt really well handled by
Clare Byrne.
They quite clearly never wanted to go public, but that they felt they had to, that the system let them down that much. But if you look at Women's Aid figures, show that since 1996, 137 women have been killed in their own homes, 16 children killed alongside them, and that 87% of those women were killed by a man they knew. And it struck me that Clodagh Haugh actually and her children will have a double legacy that I hope in time will prove a comfort to the family. The first being actually the way in which this was reported in the first couple of days, that whole thing of the media saying, nice man, lovely man, responsible man, teacher, and where Clodagh Haugh was practically written out of the picture.
Her name is
Clodagh. I don't think anybody will ever, no journalist will ever approach another situation like that without learning the lessons of that. And the second I hope is that even the number, the Women's Aid helpline, I think calls have soared in the last few weeks. The notion that maybe some other woman in that situation might be assisted, and that in future that this thing that Charlie Flanagan is talking about now, that that process will be in place for any further family.
Journalists Alison O'Connor and Niamh Lyons. Another shocking murder was discussed on the Today Show on Thursday when Rose and Jim Callaly joined Sean O'Rourke. Their daughter, Rachel Callaly, was murdered by her husband, Joe O'Reilly, in their family home in North County Dublin. He got life, but next month his application for parole is up for review.
When I heard he was eligible again, I thought to myself, gosh, that 3 years has flown in. And then I discovered since that it's going to be every 2 years from now on. And it just, it's not on.
Yeah, one thing you're allowed to do is you can write a letter, and I want to quote an extract from the letter that you wrote, Jim, to the parole board, and you say, "Writing this letter about all the horrible times we had, I found it upsetting to recall it all. From the early times when I used to wake up sitting upright in the bed, screaming with nightmares I was going through, thinking of the savage and cruel attack her husband and father of her two children inflicted to end her young life at 30 years of age. I thought several times I would lose my sanity. The devastating effect it had on Rose and our children. He, Joe O'Reilly, has ruined several people's lives. He is a very devious and dangerous person, and he should never be let out of prison."
Yeah, exactly.
You obviously believe, like Rose, life should mean life.
Yeah, for a person of that calibre, you know.
Yeah, but I suppose it's rare for people who get a life sentence to spend the rest of their life behind bars.
Yeah, well, you see, there's more to it than a fellow that got a life sentence. He's a psychopath.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd be a danger to let out on the public, you know. That's what I reckon. Yeah, I saw him in action.
Yes.
You know, he reenacted the murder scene in front of us. And that's where he gets his kicks out of, seeing the look in your face. And that's his tendency. So, you know, if anyone crossed him, if he was out, he wouldn't think twice of annihilating him, you know.
Well, that's, I suppose, something that he has to try to persuade the parole board would not happen. And he gets a chance to go before that board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you don't.
No, and I feel strongly about that. I think if that's afforded to him, we should have the same. I would love to sit and listen to what he put forward. I would just like to see his face and what reason, you know, he would give.
And he never expressed any regret or anything
never,
like that?
Never, no.
No, he never. Didn't.
Rose and Jim Callaly with Sean O'Rourke on Thursday. And if you've been affected by any of the issues raised, you can get help by contacting Women's Aid 24-hour free phone helpline on 1800 341 900 or the Samaritans on 116 123. A million miles away from all that heartbreak and trauma, Philip King's tribute to singer Irla O'Linnard was a thing of beauty. Irla was just back from New York, where he's teaching at Princeton, and is about to perform a series of sold-out gigs with the Gloaming at the National Concert Hall later this month.
Did you know very early on that it was going to be a life in music, a life in song, and a life out on the highway for you?
Well, the only thing I really knew was that I knew the ecstasy of the song. I felt that.
Very early.
So early. I mean, I remember one time doing a gig in Dublin when I was a young fella, and the promoter gave out to me for singing, for having too much feeling and didn't want to pay me. And perhaps he was right. But I just got these feelings and I just wanted to track them down.
Well, I sensed that from you when we first spoke in a studio like this in Dublin.
Yeah, I mean, there's a part of me always wants to go to that place. I don't even know what to call it. I don't know where it is. I don't know what it is. But it's the only way of getting there is music.
That's heaven.
It is a suspension. It's where it's almost a nowhere. It's a beautiful nowhere. I love being there.
So the sensation of, you know, standing in the middle of a floor at home and singing a song and standing in Carnegie Hall or in the National Concert Hall, and you're about to do a big long run there. When you close your eyes, is there any way you could describe to us where you go? Does the song take over?
It does. It's a sort of a dream space. There's always a little bit of craft and there's danger. I'm a wreck side stage. I have fellas patting me down, trying to keep me calm, rubbing my shoulder. But when I walk onto the boards, I seem to be... I'm already singing. I'm in song mode. And then your mouth opens and it's really not even me. I don't think I'm hearing me. I always thought it was somebody else, something other. And I'm very happy with that equation, if that is the case. Because really, at the end of the day, you are making an artifact. You only own it for as long as it takes your mouth to make it.
Make sure be me come. Imchau lite le frosi von chu a rihum le bullen vaden Slerihim Lamon Leeten Frozy Arihim Lamon.
So beautiful, Iarla Lenard, heard on The South Wind Blows last Saturday night. Edna O'Brien's racy first novel, The Country Girls, featuring best friends Kate and Baba, scandalised 60s Ireland, so much so that Edna O'Brien was read off the altar and her book banned. She's since gone on to become one of the country's most revered creative artists, and on Wednesday, The Country Girls trilogy was chosen as this year's Dublin One City, One Book choice. Edna spoke with RT's art and media correspondent Sinead Crowley.
When I sat down to write The Country Girls in a room in London on my children's windowsill, it was a wide windowsill, I was, and I realised I was, as lonely as a bird.
Edna O'Brien remembers writing her classic novel, The Country Girls, the story of young women leaving their childhood behind.
I had wanted to leave Ireland. I felt constricted. I knew without knowing that to write The Country Girls, I would have people looking over my shoulder. And it's hard enough to do it, believe you me, with just yourself looking over your shoulder.
The trilogy is now being celebrated as Dublin's One City, One Book choice, a big change given that The Country Girls was initially banned here.
No, it was not celebrated. If the, whatever the opposite word to celebration is, that's what it got, which was sticks and stones and cudgels. It hurt me because, you see, writing is not an easy job. And the one thing is you write alone, not the one thing. The primary thing is you write alone, and therefore you would like or dream of a bit of support. And to not only not have support, but to be blamed for what seemed to other people unjustifiably a crime is not great. What it made me feel was how frightened people were, and in some extent are, of the truthful written word.
Events will take place across the city in April to encourage people to read the trilogy. Its author says she's delighted.
Now comes the time when people won't tell me that they had to buy this book up north and they had to read it under the sheet. How it's done, I don't know. But it is true, it was read furtively and covered with brown paper, etc. I want young audience, for my own sake, and for life's sake, because whatever else the book has, The Country Girls trilogy, it has feeling.
The amazing Edna O'Brien, still working hard at 88. And her next book, inspired by the kidnapping by Boko Haram of hundreds of schoolgirls in Nigeria 5 years ago, will be published in September. The writer Sebastian Barry has long been an admirer of Edna O'Brien's work. When he took on the public role of Irish Laureate for Fiction nearly a year ago, he promised that aside from teaching in UCD and New York, he'd bring his Lifelines book club to places like direct provision centres, dialysis units and prisons, places where people are confined. In a catch-up conversation with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday, he described the process and his visit to the Central Mental Hospital in Dundrum in Dublin.
Well, just by the accident of being rather elderly now, I do have 7 novels and they choose one of those. So I think in Down in Waterford it was The Secret Scripture, for instance. And indeed, it's an appropriate book because Roseanne in that book is quite constrained. She's been sectioned for life in the novel. So there's a link there. Is it very practical in a way? You go in, I read to them, I talk to them a bit, and then the important part is when they talk to me.
And you've been to the Central Mental Hospital?
Again, I had no idea what that could be going in. I was very anxious to do it. You're in a group of maybe 40 people. To some degree, you feel in your heart that their tickets for life have been cancelled in some way. I mean, truly constrained by their unwellness. And yet, when they begin to speak, when somebody stands up to talk to me, they do speak with that strange grace that I heard in the voices of the men who had been in the industrial schools. Do you remember a few years ago when they finally were speaking on the radio and they spoke with this magnificent eloquence? It's as if that when you are put so grievously against the wall, that's when either you crumble or you start to remake yourself. And it seemed to me that they were in the Central Mental Hospital, they were remaking themselves in an overwhelming manner. And also a woman stood up and told me that no one knows we're here. Thank you for coming, because no one knows we're here and I'm not sure anyone cares we are here.
Gosh, that's a very sad thing to hear, isn't it?
Well, that's been, even in the Centre for Successful Ageing, which is in St. James's and, you know, beautiful palace that Chuck Feeney gave them, I think, that was also a note struck. No one knows we're here. And it reminds me of that moment when I went in with Ivor Brown when his hospital was on fire years ago, and I was at dinner with him and he brought me in and we went through unfamiliar ways to reach the part of the hospital he needed to see. And so we came through long rooms full of the women of the hospital in particular, and the great windows and the lights of the city below. But although you could see the city could no longer see them. And that feeling of being put aside.
Sebastian Barry, the laureate for Irish fiction, with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday. There was great excitement last week when it emerged that the EuroMillions jackpot of over €175 million was won by a syndicate of family members from North County Dublin. Well, yesterday, Sean O'Rourke spoke with Jerry Brown, one of the nine, whose wife was watching the RTÉ news, realised they'd won, and famously kept the golden tickets safe in an Argus catalogue overnight.
Very hard to keep a secret when the news is that good.
Yeah, and I have to say, the people in Donegal, from where I'm from now, all the reporters that was there, we would live nearest the shop, all the reporters was there. They, not one of them told them where we lived.
It's a huge amount of money to take in. Did you get any sleep the first night?
I probably had about six vodkas, so I slept pretty all right.
And what about everybody else?
Well, I don't know.
I'm just thinking, like, my first concern would have been to keep that ticket safe. You say she put it into the Argus catalogue, but, I mean, you'd nearly want a security car and a guard and an army escort then to take it to Lotto headquarters. I mean, yeah. How did you do that particular manoeuvre?
We just went in the bus, and when we were coming back, the whole office in the bus and the cameras, the RTÉ and all, and we're all in Donegal, and we waved at the people going by and never even seen us.
That was the first day, was it?
The first day, yeah.
And did you go on the bus then yesterday to collect the money?
No, we just all went in separately.
A fleet of limos, I'd imagine, no?
Fleet of limos, yeah.
Is that what you did do?
Ah, no. We all just went to cars and friends and that.
An absolutely staggering amount of money. I mean, have you been able, apart from the six vodkas now, have you been able to keep to your normal life, Jerry?
No, not this week we hadn't, now. But I would be hoping to get back to it because, you know, I'd rather just go back the way I was, you know, happy enough before I won it, so I don't want it to change too much.
Like, you can literally buy pretty much anything at this stage, like a Ferrari or a trip around the world, or what's being discussed? I mean, what are the kind of ideas knocking around?
Well, for me, I'd probably buy one of the best bikes you can buy. I'm mad into cycling, so that's the only thing I'd be thinking of.
Are you talking about a push bike now?
Yeah, push bike, yeah.
Well, I suppose the most you spend on that would be, what, 5,000 or something like that?
That'd be only a cheap one. No, you'd pay 14,000, 15,000, no bother.
It's very refreshing to talk to you, Jerry, I have to say. You seem very much to have your feet on the ground and you would want to keep it like that.
Yeah, well, that's it. I would rather just stay the way I am.
Yeah.
Like, I suppose if I won it 30 years ago, it might be different, but, you know, at our age, it's not as big a deal. Probably the best thing in the whole lot is what you can do for other people, actually. That's the nicest thing about it.
And what do you think you might be doing?
Well, look after your kids and grandkids and brothers and sisters and all that, so that's it.
Multi-millionaire Jerry Brown with Sean O'Rourke yesterday. It's 30 years since Belfast solicitor Pat Finucane was shot dead at home in front of his wife and young children by loyalist paramilitaries. On Wednesday in London, his family lost a Supreme Court challenge over the decision not to hold a public inquiry into his killing. But significantly, they won a declaration that an effective investigation into his death has not been carried out. Pat Finucane's son, Michael Finucane, also a solicitor, spoke with Claire Byrne on the News at One.
The whole family is
delighted with the ruling. We asked the UK Supreme Court to examine the response of the British government to our request for a public inquiry. We said it didn't comply with the applicable legal standards, and the court has resoundingly agreed with us. They have said that the UK government has an obligation to protect and vindicate the right to life. That means investigating murders, and particularly contentious murders like that of Pat Finucane, when they occur, and they must do so in a particular way. And the court's judgment sets out, item by item, how the UK government has failed to meet the required standard.
But it has also said the decision not to hold the public inquiry was done in good faith, and it has left it up to the British government to decide what, if anything, to do next. So where does it go from here?
Well, it's slightly more nuanced than they made the decision in good faith. We argue that it was done in bad faith, and the court has said you'll have to produce compelling evidence that that is so, and I'm afraid you haven't done that. But they have gone on to say that the investigation established by David Cameron's government and ultimately carried out by the late Sir Desmond de Silva QC did not meet the required legal standard under the European Convention on Human Rights. His investigation was not faulted. They said that he was diligent and careful and thorough, but he was effectively operating with one hand tied behind his back. He couldn't compel witnesses, and at least one important witness refused to speak to him without really giving good reason.
It's 30 years since your father died. How has all of this impacted you as a family, continuing on this lengthy legal fight as you have?
I was struck by something my brother John said recently, Claire, and it's the murder of Pat Finucane and all of the surrounding circumstances is moving into the realm of a generational hurt. So it's not just my mother and my siblings who feel his loss so acutely. We now have children, nephews and nieces, who never even met my father, and they feel pain at his loss and his absence. And the wider community feels pain and loss at his absence and the hugely controversial and appalling circumstances of his murder. So that's where we now find ourselves. We're hopefully moving towards a point where we can resolve this issue, but we're not going to give up. And we want what we think is the correct solution to the issues surrounding my father's murder. And that's a public inquiry. And we're not going to stop until we get one.
Michael Finucane heard on Wednesday's News at 1. The controversy over current child protection standards in Scouting Ireland, raised by the child and family agency TUSLA and brought to the attention of the Dáil by Minister Catherine Zappone, raged all week and was discussed on the gathering yesterday by commentators Alison O'Connor and Niamh Lyons.
What is your assessment of this row that's blown up between TUSLA and Scouting Ireland? I suppose that the fire was originally lit in the Dáil by Minister Zappone.
Yeah, with Minister Zappone, something I've said about her before is that she's pathologically honest. She is someone who just can't withhold anything. When it comes out, she's truthful about it. Maybe another minister might have sat in this for a while and done some work in the background. She decided to go straight into the Dáil and put it on the record and obviously informed the opposition. A lot of opposition TDs would say that's the way to go and that's what they would prefer. The notion now, however, is that perhaps she has scared the horses a little bit. There's plans for trips this weekend that are now have a big question mark over them, although it looks like they are still going ahead.
First of all, I suppose I should say I have two kids that will go out tonight separately to Brownies and to Girl Guides, two fabulous organisations, and I have nothing but the utmost admiration for the people who run that, who take your kids, who take them away on trips. I think they're just amazing.
And trust.
And trust, absolutely. I feel desperately sorry for the equivalent of those people in Scouting Ireland and how they must feel now. However, the bottom line is the protection of children, and Scouting Ireland has an appalling record in the past. And I sort of thought that maybe they might have had their cough a bit further softened by their history than how they've been behaving in the last day or two. I think it was good that you had Pat Rabbit on. I think it's good that Pat Rabbit is the chairman of TUSLA now, is quite steadying. You're left wondering and guessing what went on between the two sides and trying to read between the lines, and maybe Minister Zappone did run into the Dáil, but what would any of us have said to her if we heard she had this in her possession and hadn't informed anyone?
But the point was that there was normal business going on. I mean, TUSLA saying it was part of the usual business process that it raised concerns, and then because...
Yeah, but as Pat Rabbit pointed out then, Ian Elliott, he went, as he said, behind the scrum.
But this was... to the minister. That was my phrase, but in fairness to Pat Rabbit. But the point, I suppose, is that
Newsla didn't feel the need to alert the minister, and they just were going about their business. Yeah, and then because they went so heavily on
Scotland,
that they got alarmed.
I
and they
think
went
we could take this attitude
head.
If this was and then the a run of the mill. But this is scouting before. Ireland. You have to look at the history there and how they were dragged kicking and screaming.
From the Today Show yesterday. Brexit, 27 days to go, and is reality finally beginning to bite? Taoiseach Leo Varadkar was doorstepped by media eager to analyse the latest twists and turns.
OK, better make it quick. My life has gone turbo jet set lately with all this Brexit stuff. Got on a sneaky holiday to Portugal before the big summit in Egypt. Toast delighted they're extending Brexit chaos. What? Whenever I need a rest, I can pop over on a city break and call it EU biz.
How did your meeting with the British Prime Minister go?
God, which one? It used to be such a buzz visiting the set of my favourite film, Love Actually. Now it's totes orcs. We literally have nothing to say to each other. These days, Theresa May and Brexit reminds me more of the old lady at the end of Titanic, who's throwing the last thing she had of value into the sea.
What's your take on the current state of the Brexit talks?
Loving it. What? Now that it's taking longer than our efforts to draw Metrolink on a map, I can totes chillax and enjoy the Paddy's Day junket. It's going to be epic.
Taoiseach, do you stand by your comments that Irish citizens who went to fight for ISIS would be welcome back to Ireland?
Absolutorama. With Fianna Fáil made an absolute balls of our economy, hashtag never forget. A lot of Irish citizens had to emigrate to find work, and not everyone was cut out for fruit picking in Australia. But now, under Fine Gael's leadership, all sorts of people are returning home to a booming economy, but even in areas I paid no attention to, like towns with a Supermax or a Roma 2. I'm delighted to say there's been regional progress, with gangland crime even expanding to places like Drogheda. There could be opportunities for ex-ISIS fighters there, in fact. Anywho, I've got to run. I think I'm needed in Rome for Brexit talks with the Italian PM. The nightlife is a maze, by the way. And then Greece, maybe Cyprus, Sicily, somewhere nice. You know how it is. Ciao, guys.
Oliver Callan and his crew heard on Callan's Kicks last night. The tradition of Uilleann pipe playing in Ireland throughout the 19th and 20th century was very much male dominated, with great players like Seamus Ennis, Willie Clancy and Leo Rousham, and of course others. But last Sunday on The Rolling Wave, piper Louise Mulcahy discussed her research on women Uilleann pipers with Aoife Cormac. And while historically there weren't that many of them, they certainly existed and were even written about by Captain Francis O'Neill in his book Irish Minstrels and Musicians.
So how many women does O'Neill mention in that? So that publication was published, I think, in 1913. He has a few then in that
book. There are a number of women profiled. There's an iconic image of Anna Barry from 1901, and she's pictured in a pristine white dress and white headgear. And an adjudicator from the day, from the competition, it was from the piping competition, said she looked like a dove amongst a flock of old crows. And there's also another piping image of a Mrs. Murphy from a piping competition, again held in Dublin in the early 1900s, and she's pictured centre of that. And then there's a number of women profiled. There's Molly Morrissey from the Cork Pipers Club and Mae McCarthy from the Cork Pipers Club also, and they're said to have, in the publication it says that they were extremely talented individuals, could learn 3 and 4 tunes in a night, they were proficient dancers. Extensive touring schedule. Mae McCarthy toured in Birmingham and Wales, and I suppose cultural nationalism provided them with a platform for performance abroad as well.
And Louise Mulcahy herself is no slouch on the pipes. The Munster Jig, played by Louise Mulcahy, and heard on The Rolling Wave with Aoife Cormac, Sunday nights at 9. The baritone and broadcaster Austin Gaffney died last month at the age of 90, and John Bowman paid tribute to him on Bowman Sunday 8:30, and in this excerpt, Austin is interviewed by Marion Finucane in 2003 about his first singing teacher, Mrs. Boylan.
Mrs. Boylan, she was a rather large lady, and she was very forthright in what she had to say. And when she had to say it, you listened. You listened. She she would stand up. Gaffney, come here. Why didn't you learn your piece? I had to do my homework. Forget your homework. Learn the piece. She was a wonderful lady.
She obviously spotted your voice.
She did. She did.
At what age would that have been?
That would have been at, say, 11, 12, up to 14.
Right.
My voice broke when I was, 14.
Right.
On the eve of a broadcast. On the day of a broadcast, pardon me. My very first solo broadcast. I was to go into Radio Éireann, as it was known then, in Henry Street, to do a 15-minute spot, as they were 15-minute recital spot.
Mm.
The station used to open at 5 o'clock.
In the afternoon.
In the afternoon. And then at 5.15, on certain days, they would have the recital spot. And I was due to do, as a boy soprano, to sing. And I woke up that morning and I was talking like that.
Just like that?
Just like that, yes. And the day before, I was talking like a boy, you know.
And can I ask you a question?
You can, of course.
If you're a boy soprano,
yes,
and if your voice is going to break, is there any guarantee what you'll come back as, so to speak?
Absolutely none. Now, I was a soprano, and I came back as a baritone.
But you don't know this beforehand?
No, no way.
I mean, do you even know that you will still have a singing voice?
You don't. No, you don't.
It
this
must
is the
be very
awful
scary.
Thing. Well, I suppose it is, yes. But at 14 years of age, it's not of any great consequence, except that I was mad keen. I was so mad keen on music and singing at the time. If it hadn't come back, I would have been very disappointed.
All married men and sweethearts gay, now hear the words that I do say. Right, I fall the diddle tire, I fall the diddle faldy do da day do. It's how I got a house and land, my darling, from her mother. Right, I fall the diddle tire, I fall the diddle faldy do da day do. Her hair as black as any snow, and her skin as fair can be. And of all the girls I e'er did see, she's the only one that pleases me. And now my song is ended, for I marry the Palatine's daughter. Right, I fall the diddle tire, I fall the diddle faldy do da day do.
The Palatine's Daughter, one of the few happy love songs in the Irish tradition, sung there by Austin Gaffney. And you can hear more about the life and work of Austin Gaffney tomorrow morning on Bowman, Sunday, 8:30. Apprentice chef Eniola Salami is originally from Nigeria and arrived in Ireland when she was a young girl. She recently won Irish Junior Chef of the Year, and as she told Evelyn O'Rourke, she got her love of cooking from her mother.
So I'm originally from Nigeria, and I moved here when I was younger, and like my influence for food came from my mom. Food is a big, big thing at home and in our culture. So when you're young, you're brought into the kitchen very young to start cooking, to start learning everything. So like being in the kitchen with my mom gave me that oomph that I want to be in a chef, that I wanted to, like, you know, start cooking.
So she wasn't a professional chef as such. She did was like your home cook,
yeah,
who loved cooking.
Yeah, she did a few courses, but like home cooking was her thing.
So tell me then, you were in school and what happened?
Well, the funny thing is culinary arts wasn't my first choice. I was in hospitality management and I hated it. I was miserable. So I did a few things and I got into culinary arts and like I never looked back.
When you tell people what you're doing, mm-hmm, what kind of comments do people make to you? I mean, do you get lots of stuff about, you know, oh, the hours are tough? Is it hard to be a woman in a kitchen?
Mm-hmm. We as chefs will know how the hours are tough. Like you do long 16 hours. Like when I did my internship in first year, I was not expecting the long hours. Like, and I did it in Lox, but I was the only female in the kitchen. So that drove me to kind of like work hard and like stick to the hours, like, and I'm going to complete it. And I've been there for a while, yeah.
What is it like to be the only woman in the kitchen?
It's kind of like, it's easier for guys. They have like all this male role models. But as females, you have to use your passion and drive to be your own role model in a kitchen. That's kind of how it runs, yeah.
And what's the dream and how do you get there?
Travel is my thing. So me traveling and my love for food, I want to combine them and probably have my own restaurant in the future, probably.
Evelyn O'Rourke reporting for the Today Show on Monday. Food was also on the menu on The Business. Richard Curran's guests were Dennis Cotter, vegetarian owner of the famed Café Paradiso in Cork, and his supplier Ulton Walsh of Gurtnanane Farm. They're just back from Paris, where they won Collaboration of the Year at the World Restaurant Awards.
What was
that
one?
Whole thing was quite bizarre for me anyway, because I'm not really used to going anywhere at all. So going to Paris for a world award was overwhelming to a degree, to be honest.
all these beautiful people, hundreds of beautiful people, and there was oysters and foie gras and, you know, all of that. So it was a bit strange for me, to be honest. But I did
enjoy
it.
Good night.
They were good people, really good people, actually. So it was a good night, but I was almost glad to get back picking veg in the rain after 3 days in Paris.
Enough of that glamorous
exactly,
lifestyle.
Exactly.
From the business last Saturday. Well, the country, it seems, is in the grip of dance fever, but not only of the Dancing with the Stars glitz and glamour variety. On Countrywide, Brenda Donoghue went to the social dance class in Moat in County Westmeath, where she met Teresa Dolan and Michael Seary.
I'm a widow for the last 10 years.
How difficult was it to get back into the social scene for yourself?
It was very difficult. It was 7 years before I moved out to the social scene. My brothers used to bring me, and they'd bring me here, and they'd bring me to Ballinasloe, any place to be a dance locally. And I just couldn't wait for the night to be over to go home. That's the feeling. I'm sure there's lots more women in my situation that feel the very same.
It's such a pity this is the radio, because you're both smiling and you're so happy.
So we never stop smiling. No. That's our problem.
I ask how old are you? Do you mind? Is that really rude?
Well, do you know what we are? Yes, we're so. Two recycled teenagers. That's what we are.
That's what we are. No, Michael, what is it about this lovely lady you like?
Well, she's a genuine person for a start, and I trust her with my life.
You can't get better than that, can you?
No, and thank you very much, Michael. It's lovely to hear that. I love going out, I love meeting people, and I love dancing. And he's the one person I can dance with.
Brenda Donoghue reporting for Countrywide with Damien O'Reilly. But I leave you now with a song from Galway singer Alton Conlon. He played live on the Today Show on Thursday, along with musicians Micheál O'Connor and John O'Connell, In the Blink of an Eye. Gramaha Gavaswar Golúder, Tasulam Gurwanshiv Saltas Glor, Agus Gamishiv Lom Taka Anamakiana, Antochtan Johugin, Gajishin, Gajeshib Slán.
Why so hard on yourself? There's nobody else here putting you down. It's just you on the ropes, in the ring on your own, in a house on the outskirts of town. Let me go, she cries. There's some